Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today we have not one but two different topics. First up is, will an election really make a difference? And that is the question that two individuals who I have a lot of respect for, Chris Hedges and Abby Martin, will be discussing in depth. I'm sure you're going to want to share with other people what you've learned, so remember, guide them over to prn.fm to the archives. Then we're going to take a look at something that has not been discussed by the mainstream media whatsoever, how the Department of Defense and the Pentagon lost $21 trillion. It's unaccounted for. Now imagine the amount of money that is. It's unfathomable. But that's how much that no one's been held to account for. And this is where the Corbett Report, James Corbett, and is interviewing Catherine Austin Fitz, who was a federal head of an agency, and she did investigation on this, and she has some very interesting ideas. So we'll hear what they have to say and what they're projecting is the cause. Now, to our program, Abby Martin interviewing Chris Hedges.
Chris, last time we talked, it was immediately after the election. 2 years into Trump's presidency, give us an assessment of how Trump has further deteriorated the last vestiges of our democratic institutions.
Right. I would argue that it's not Trump who has accelerated the deterioration of our democratic institutions, but by all of those forces within the political establishment, and I would argue the press, that it are tasked with defending an open society. They've failed us. I mean, Trump, if the rule of law was in place, could have been impeached on the first day he took the presidency under the Emoluments Clause. He's utterly shameless about Mar-a-Lago or the Trump Hotel in Washington, which is raking in millions of dollars from lobbyists and foreign governments. In fact, he, in the publicity material, puts out the information that you may be able to get your picture with the president if you go to one of his golf courses. So it's the breakdown of the rule of law, the inability on the part of decayed and anemic institutions, which predated Trump. He's clearly committed obstruction of justice, for instance, on innumerable policy decisions such as moving behind the scenes to allow Saudi Arabia to build nuclear reactors. This can only be under law approved by Congress. It doesn't matter. I mean, so just on and on and on. It's an evisceration of the rule of law, which is what despots or demagogues do, but they are empowered by a democratic society or failed democracy that no longer does what it's tasked to do, which is defend the rule of law. So it's Mitch McConnell, it's the Democrats. And let's be clear, the Democrats kind of want Trump in 2020. I think they're very misguided, but they think they can cough up a figure like Joe Biden, who's just sort of a goofy male version of Hillary Clinton, and use that playbook. I don't think it's going to work. There are systemic issues that are actually far more serious than Trump himself.
Right. It's interesting that they're putting forward Joe Biden because Obama picked him specifically to pander to Republicans, and they're actually audaciously...
Obama did a pretty good job of pandering to Republicans, yeah, too, of course, especially the banking sector and the war industry and, you know, the intelligence agencies. And The problem is that the Democratic elite, which is a creation of corporate power, it's the more acceptable face of corporate power. They're mm-hmm. not naked misogynists, although Biden, look at Anita Hill, and they are not openly Islamophobes or racists. Although, of course, the structures that they support oppress women, especially poor women, oppress people of color. Biden was instrumental, along with Clinton, in more than doubling our prison population. And people forget tripling or quadrupling the length of sentences. And half of our prison population have never been charged with physically harming another person. 94% of them never got a jury trial. I mean, it's really, it is the latest iteration of slavery, neo-slavery. And the Democrats, because they wanted, and Biden was at the epicenter of this, to seize back the law and order issue from the Republicans, created it. So, but the Democrats are terrified of Sanders and Warren, although I find them very tepid figures. And if we look at history, we will see that even the whiff of socialism has always seen the business elites, the industrial class, make an alliance with the fascists. This was certainly was always a very uncomfortable relationship between the German industrialists and the Nazis, who were an array of buffoonish characters, including Hitler, who couldn't even speak proper German. And it's an uncomfortable relationship, but they'd far rather that relationship than see the rise of any social movement which will impede their further consolidation of power and their further consolidation of profits. So we have to remember that when Trump came into office, what did he do? He turned to the most powerful forces within the corporate state. Tax cuts, which saw Amazon, which would they make $10 billion worth of profits. They paid no income taxes. He boosted the military spending, even though they didn't even ask for it, by 10%. And he empowered the intelligence agencies to carry out activities, as we see it especially with immigrants and undocumented workers, which brings us closer and closer to a police state. So he placated those forces. And however repugnant they may find Trump to be, and I think that many of them do, the kind of Princeton graduates who run work at Goldman Sachs, for instance, and would love to put a more acceptable face like Biden, somebody who will carry out their bidding with more decorum, they'll nevertheless work with him as they have worked with him.
And the war on terror has, of course, supercharged or turbocharged this entire kind of evisceration of the rule of law. You were a main plaintiff Hedges versus Obama to sue the Obama administration for the National Defense Authorization Act in 2012. And you and others at the time were arguing it wasn't that necessarily Obama was going to use this. It was someone like a Trump.
Sure. I mean, you don't want to hand that kind of power to the government. Obama, when he, and essentially what Section 1021 does is it overturns the 1878 Posse Comitatus Act, which prohibits the military from being used as a domestic police force. Under that Section 1021, the military can seize, in the language of that section, people who are identified with being with a Taliban, Al-Qaeda, or quote-unquote associated forces, whatever that is, and putting them in military detention facilities, including our offshore penal colonies, without giving them access to due process or habeas corpus or anything else. And they refuse to hear the case, so it's law. But what's interesting is that in the meantime, the lawyers, Bruce Afron and Carl Mayer, reached out to the Democratic Party leadership and said, because it's renewed every year, said, all you have to do is write in there that it doesn't apply to U.S. citizens and we drop the lawsuit. But of course, they didn't write that in because it was written for U.S. citizens. So I think it's because they ultimately, you know, the NSA, and they've all run scenarios about the effects of societal breakdown, whether centered around catastrophic climate disruption or financial crash. I mean, and they felt that they needed the military as an instrument, which clearly a figure like Trump will use, and not only use, but authorized to use lethal force.
The GOP was collapsing before they were able to latch on to Trump. So
right.
I guess that's where I'm worried things are going. They know Trump is really kind of their last hope. I don't know if they can really win without him. I mean, and he's been throwing out these trial balloons of not wanting to leave the presidency in 8 years.
Right.
We know the state of the Democratic Party.
Right.
So it is getting more extreme and potentially more desperate, and we're zero 9/11s away from actually something very bad happening.
Well, or an economic crash would be, serve the same purpose, a crisis. These, totalitarian groups always need to consolidate their power through a crisis, the Reichstag fire or mm-hmm. something. So, both parties destroyed. Neither the Democrats or mm-hmm. the Republicans function as traditional parties. The base has no relevance. You can't even get on the DNC unless you're a superdelegate, mm-hmm. which means you're a lobbyist or, the stooge who works for a lobbyist or something. So neither of them function as political parties. And the Republican Party, which was pushing through all sorts of policies which have no support with the majority of the public. You notice now they're not talking much about the tax cuts. So they've pushed the culture wars, abortion, homosexuality, immigrants, et cetera. And they kind of set the stage for a figure like Trump because the actual policies that they engage in, like the Democrats, most Americans don't want. And so the parties have had to retreat into, now we have a gay candidate, now we have a woman candidate, mm-hmm. now, and not that it's not important to empower disenfranchised groups, but it becomes like Cornel West said of Obama, he's just a black mascot for Wall Street. It's a piece of advertising. And the real fundamental issues, which both parties agree on, let's remember that 90%+ of everything that's carried out is bipartisan.
Right.
Completely bipartisan. But MSNBC and Fox, they're not going to talk about that, and neither is CNN, because they need to create this arena-like situation where there's a constant enmity and you can never come to a consensus, and it's a kind of mortal battle to the death for the soul of the republic. But it's all fiction because in almost every issue, there is no difference between the Republicans and the Democrats. We're in a very, very serious moment in American history where I don't see, certainly, through the electoral system, there's no way out. We are headed eventually towards another financial dislocation. Now, I'm not an economist. I don't know how severe, but Goldman Sachs and Citibank, they're all back to doing what they were doing before. Mm-hmm. These bubbles are not sustainable. But anyway, a crisis like that will certainly, that's when the monsters will really come out. We already have a president who openly incites violence, but you get people to think and speak in the language of violence, it doesn't take very long until that violence begins to characterize your society. And we're already seeing it with the mass shootings at synagogues, and we had a misguided guy living out of a van in Florida send pipe bombs, which if they'd gone off would have decapitated most of the Democratic Party leadership.
Let's talk more about the rhetoric of Trump today. I mean, at a rally the other day, he was kind of laughing at someone bringing up, hey, let's just shoot the immigrants at the border.
Only in the panhandle.
Yeah, only in the panhandle. And then you have just this open incitement to violence, essentially, against the two sitting Muslim congresswomen.
Yeah. When you get people to speak in this language, it's finally a very short step to carrying out violence itself. And it's often, in a dark kind of way, humorous. So you see Trump at a rally and somebody shouts, shoot him, and he says, only in the panhandle. But eventually, they start getting shot. Well, they already are, but they start getting shot en masse in the panhandle. You demonize a figure like Ilhan Omar, and eventually, hopefully not, but somebody like her or she gets shot. I mean, there are consequences to lustily advocating and embracing violence, which Trump, again, is openly doing with there's no external restraint. And because the broadcast media loves Trump, he's kind of the perfect foil. His stuff is, these kinds of taunts are just disseminated throughout the country. it's eerie for someone like me who has covered for 20 years disintegrating societies, including the war in El Salvador or the former Yugoslavia, to just watch a kind of all of those patterns being repeated with nobody standing up. You know, it's that Auden line, the best lack all conviction and the worst are full of passionate intensity, with, you know, all of those people who should be standing up not standing up to try and halt it.
Mm-hmm. You've warned about Christianized fascism taking root.
Right.
Just looking at the judges that Trump has appointed, I think more than any other president at this point in his term.
Right.
It is interesting to me that the Democrats are not more up in arms about this. You know, we heard a lot about Kavanaugh, but what about all these other judges who are now in there for lifetime appointments? Talk about the significance of that alone.
Well, that's very important because I think the judiciary has been the last readout, the last kind of barrier towards this corporate totalitarianism. And now that's been eviscerated, especially with Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court. Let's not forget that Obama's appointments, now many of them were blocked, but Obama's appointments to the federal courts were not very good. They were all corporatists as well. They were a kind of, you know, it was what that book, Friendly Fascism. I mean, they were a more palatable form of, I suppose, corporate fascism. But they came out of corporate law. And what you're getting now is ideologically driven judges approved by the Federalist Society, embraced by the Christian right. I mean, the reason Trump had to push Kavanaugh through so quickly is because the Christian right was worried that if Trump lost control of the Congress, they wouldn't be able to get Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court, who, despite what Susan Collins told us, is there to overturn Roe v. Wade. Originally, he wasn't even on the list. He was, you know, he was promoted to the number one pick by that base. So Trump, and I think I said this before last time I was here, I mean, he has no ideology of his own. There's an ideological void. But this Christian fascism is rapidly filling it, and we've seen the advance of these Christian fascists in the figures like Mike Pompeo, John Bolton, Elliot Abrams. They come out of this very fray. I knew Elliot Abrams. I had to deal with him when I covered the wars in Central America in the 80s. I mean, these are very frightening figures who either are unwilling or incapable of understanding nuance. They're not literate historically or culturally. They believe exclusively in the language of violence, the language of force. We're watching these efforts along with Bibi Netanyahu to push us into a war with Iran, which is, I spent 7 years in the Middle East and a lot of time in Iran. This is just utter insanity.
And a lot of them believe literally in the Bible. I mean, Mike Pompeo said that everything that he's doing is for the rapture.
Right, and Pence. And, you know, this Betsy DeVos pushes charter schools because she once said it's good for the kingdom, i.e. you give federal money to Christian fascists to indoctrinate children in Christian schools. And as you know, I come out of a deep religious tradition. I'm a graduate of Harvard Divinity School. I don't like labels too much, but I certainly remain rooted in that tradition. I don't use the word fascist lightly. These people have fused the iconography and language of the state with that of the Bible. They've sacralized state power, state chauvinism, and they are a highly organized, well-funded, and disciplined force. Those of us who are not hooked into that community don't see it, but tens of millions of Americans are indoctrinated through Christian schools and Christian broadcasting and Christian media and mega churches, which are just mini versions of the kind of narcissistic cults that Trump has now set up in the White House.
Other than the language of force, what characterizes them as fascists?
A binary view of the world, a separation of the world into us and them, good and evil, black and white. But fundamentally an externalization of evil, a belief that, you know, those of us who come out of, I think a religious tradition that isn't fascistic, understand that the greatest evil is within us. Something I learned as a war correspondent, that line between the victim and the victimizer is razor thin. We are all capable, without a lot of prodding, to become the torturer. And it is that knowledge of our own capacity for evil which allows us to constantly fight against it. These people have, for them, evil is embodied in the other who must be eradicated, the jihadist, the Muslim, the immigrant. And it is this sick belief that when you eradicate this segment of the population, or these people, somehow evil is eradicated. Except, of course, it doesn't work like that. You need a new entity to demonize, because this is an ideology based on hate, really. And it is about the sanctification of American power and white supremacy. I mean, I spent 20 years abroad. And if you look at the conflicts, I was in Central America, in the Middle East, and those are really the external expressions of white supremacy. So it is that inability to be self-critical. It is at its core about self-exaltation. It is the inability for them to struggle with the darkness that is within all of us, that is part of the human condition, and the belief that violence is a form of purification, and it is the sacralization of nationalism and nationalist symbols. And we have some of the stalwarts, I mean Pence and others, who come out of this very frightening worldview. And I think a lot of Americans who have not been in its grip don't understand how dangerous it is.
Back to the language of Trump that's kind of bringing us to that permanent lie that you talk about, as opposed to these half-truths,
right,
which define political discourse in the past. Elaborate on what you mean by that.
Well, so totalitarian systems are, this is Hannah Arendt, are always engaged in the permanent lie as opposed to the expedient lie. Politicians always lie, as I have spoken, said all governments lie. So Clinton wants to shove NAFTA down our throat and tells us it will create millions of wonderful, well-paying jobs, but it doesn't. George W. Bush tells us that there are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, except there weren't. Well, Bush and Clinton don't run around now saying that, you know, NAFTA created millions of jobs, and Bush doesn't say that there are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. The permanent lie has no fealty to the truth at all. And it becomes kind of schizophrenic, because even what in a totalitarian system you see in front of you is denied. It doesn't matter how many pictures Trump shows of the inauguration crowd, his was the largest in history. I mean, that's the permanent lie. And that's certainly another aspect of the kind of despotism that has enveloped the country, because that's how he operates. And it's different from the expedient lie. And it knocks people off balance, because there's just no, you cannot have any discourse that anymore is grounded in verifiable fact or reality. That's another step towards tyranny.
Well, a lot of these people will say they're patriotic, Chris. They're not white nationalists. They're not nationalists. Of course, that has a negative connotation. I mean, is there a difference when you're looking at nationalism versus patriotism?
Sure. I would define patriotism as those activities or activity which makes your country and your community a better place. So for me, you could argue the greatest patriot of the 20th century was Martin Luther King. But patriotism has been perverted into a deification of the warrior class. Nationalism is a disease, and I watched nationalist and covered nationalist movements around the globe. So after 9/11, we drank that very dark elixir of nationalism, which is always racist and always about self-exaltation at the expense of the other. you know, that when a country's convulsed by that kind of intoxication with nationalism, it is a temporary overcoming of the anomie or the dislocation or the despair or the alienation that much of the country feels. It's a false kind of camaraderie. But suddenly people feel that they're part of a cause. They feel that they belong again. And intellectuals are some of the most susceptible to this. And I was fighting these people. I was teaching at Princeton at the time. And they drank this Kool-Aid as deeply as everyone else. So it creates a situation where the critics, and I was one, are not just expressing another opinion, even though, of course, I'd come out of 7 years out of the Middle East, but you are actually attacking their right to exalt themselves. So when I was denouncing the calls to invade Iraq publicly, I would come into the New York Times and the phone messaging bank would be full of death threats.
Wow.
And it was that. It was these people who had been gripped by this anime and had found in this cause a way, it's a kind of false route because it doesn't work in the end, but a way to reintegrate into a society that had turned against them. And anybody who challenge that, suddenly it was an existential challenge. It just wasn't a political challenge. You know, getting rid of Trump doesn't solve the problem. As Noam Chomsky has pointed out, Pence will be worse, and Noam is right. There are, we are a deeply diseased society. And my last book, which was America, the Farewell Tour, which is pulled from Durkheim, is about what Durkheim calls that anomie, the breaking of those social bonds. That, as Durkheim, the great French sociologist, writes, creates a system whereby people engage in self-destructive behavior, whether that's the opioid crisis, suicide, gambling is another one. When I wrote it out of the Trump-tage before Trump even announced. But also, as Durkheim correctly points out, hate groups, because he says those who fervently seek the annihilation of others are really driven by longings for self-annihilation. And I write a chapter, I'm with the Proud Boys and the Three Percenters. So if we don't address that anime, if we don't address the rupture of the social bonds that allows for a healthy society, getting rid of Trump ain't gonna make any difference.
But how can the left ever challenge what is going on, this kind of decay institutionally, if the system rewards those that are horrible? The powerful are the greedy. They'll step on you and they'll kill you to get to the top. I mean, right. How does the left have a chance?
Disconnecting from the system. And, it's Alexander Herzen's great line, speaking to a bunch of revolutionaries, we think we're the doctor, we're the disease. We have to destroy the system. And that means mass civil disobedience. It means non-cooperation. It means obstructing in every way possible the ability of this system to function. That's our only hope. And we don't, climate change alone means that window is closing very, very swiftly. These people will kill us. They will carry out crimes of humanity that make what the Nazis or the Stalinists did look like child's play. They are now pushing us towards the complete extinction of the human species, and nothing will stop them because they are psychopathic figures who believe only in their own personal enrichment. At the expense, Mike Pompeo is cheering the melting of the polar ice caps because it will expose natural resources. Not only do you not want people like Pompeo and others to be in positions of leadership, but they are a guarantor that you and certainly your children will suffer tremendous misery and early death. And we can't play games with these people anymore.
Now, for the second part of our program, we're going to take a look at $21 trillion, our money, missing. No one held accountable. No one goes to jail. No one loses their job. How is that possible? Well, it is, and it's happened. And a major university professor, uncovered this. Why didn't the media cover it? Why hasn't there been congressional investigations and open hearings? Nothing. Now to the Corbett Report.
What we have built is a global national security state, which is fantastically expensive. And there are many different component parts, from the underground bases to the secret space program. But essentially, it's a, you know, I call it the tapeworm. It is a financial parasite that is simply, you know, harvesting and destroying great parts of the economy.
You're listening to The Corbett Report.
Welcome back, friends. James Corbett here, CorbettReport.com, in a conversation that is being recorded on the 26th of November, 2019. And today we are talking once again to Catherine Austin Fitz of Solari.com. And you will definitely remember her because we had the chance to talk to her not so distant past, just a couple of months ago. We were talking about the financial coup d'etat. So go back to interview 1479 if you happen to miss that conversation. I think it was a particularly important one on a particularly important topic that I've been attempting to cover for a number of years now. Just type missing trillions into my search bar and you'll find several different reports that I've done over the years on it. But more importantly, go to missingmoney.solari.com for much more detailed reports, including a detailed breakdown of the $21 trillion, yes, that is trillion with a T, $21 trillion that we know has gone missing or somehow is being fudged on the books over the past several years. You'll also want to pick up a copy of the Solari Report, specifically The Real Game of Missing Money, a two-part series that the Solari Report has recently published, details of which will be in the show notes for today's conversation along with everything else. Catherine Austin Fitz, thanks for joining us once again.
Thanks, James. It's always great to be back.
Well, it's good to have you back, especially because since the last time we talked, there has been a little bit of some sort of movement on this topic specifically. We were talking, of course, and noting about, for example, the Pentagon's failed audit last year. Well, they've right. just gone through a second failed audit. But don't worry, they were expecting this one, so it's okay. Of course they're going to fail. Is there anything, any details from this failed audit that are important for people to know about?
Well, I think what's important to recognize is that their solution for all of this is to change the policy. So we had the issuance late last year of Federal Accounting Standards Advisory Board Statement 56, which gives them permission to move things secret. And so now, you know, whether they pass an audit or not, it's meaningless. If they announce, James, they passed an audit, I would tell you it's meaningless. Because what they've done is, you know, they've solved the ultimate problem of cookbooks by simply institutionalizing secret books. And more important, it's a secret process by secret people who create secret books, and you can't know who did it or what they did. And so when you look at the financial statements of the 24 covered agencies, they didn't just do it for DOD. They did it for the covered agencies and approximately 154 other government entities. And when you add in the classification laws, it includes all the big banks and corporations doing business with government. And so literally now, when you pick up the financial statements of any of the major players at the New York Fed or any of the major financial institutions, any of the major defense contractors, you have no idea what their financial statements mean. So this is a complete, you know, this is the majority of the U.S. securities market, including the U.S. Treasuries market, going dark. So all the information that investors need to do proper due diligence is gone. And so if the Department of Defense said that they either pass or don't pass an audit, it's totally meaningless. You have no idea what it means. And it's interesting, if you look at the leadership of Federal Accounting Standards Advisory Board that promulgated this policy, what they said was their only other choice was essentially to permanently recuse the Department of Defense's financial statements. Now, I would say that's far preferable, because now what you've done is you've essentially recused the entire U.S. government financial statements. So we are real, you know, I call it Never Neverland accounting. We are truly in Never Neverland accounting. And it's quite remarkable.
So on that note, I think it is important to bring up the context. There was recently a Costs of War project at Brown University's Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs report on the War on Terror that claims 801,000 lives and $6.4 trillion have been spent on this War on Terror. Again, what meaning does any of those numbers have, given that this is coming from public statements from the DOD?
They have some meaning in the sense that we know we've spent a fantastic amount of money fielding and managing and using a global military. So we have a significant military presence and bases all around the world, and we know that it's fantastically expensive. So whether these numbers make sense or not, I don't know. Now, I happen to believe, you know, if you go back to the history of the black budget, back to 47 and 49, what you have is you have this rapacious secret operations that are constantly demanding more and more money. And of course, the more you build and invest in them, the more they demand. You know, so underground bases require maintenance, global spraying requires more spraying. If there's a secret space program, you know, spaceships get old and need to be replaced. So this thing seems to compound and grow over time. And we literally saw with FASB 56 a decision for the secret part of the finances and the secret operations to basically take over the, you know, we have an overt economy and a covert economy, and the covert economy and the hidden system of finance just basically took over everything. Now, we've been watching this for years. So for years, people have been complaining as the secret money rolled into Wall Street, you know, and took, you know, increasingly took over the media industry and other industries. We've seen complaint of the dirty money rolling in and, you know, building the offshore havens. And so this has been going on for a long, long time, because what the $21 trillion missing from the federal government since fiscal 1998 is just part of this growth of a secret national security state. And the explosion, this was growing steadily, but 9/11 really exploded the growth. And a decision, you know, the war on poverty was good, but then they turned, you know, we did the next, the war on drugs, that was good. And then they needed a new shtick, essentially. And then we started the war on terror. And it's very interesting. If you go back and research, I've just been reading a couple of books about the early part of the war on terror. You have this fantastically expensive national security state looking for terrorists, you know, and having to create terrorists so they can have a war on terror. And what we have built is a global national security state, which is fantastically expensive. And there are many different component parts, from the underground bases to the secret space program. But essentially, it's a, you know, I call it the tapeworm. It is a financial parasite that is simply, you know, harvesting and destroying great parts of the economy.
Exactly right. And if we have lost anybody about FASB 56 and what specifically happened, I will suggest they go back and listen to our first conversation where we did talk about that. But let's move on, because you did broach the subject that I really want to get into today, which is, so what is this money being used for?
Right.
And let's pick up on something that you mentioned last time that I think is important. You mentioned that the president of CalPERS back in April of 1997 warned you that they have given up on the country. They are moving all the money out starting in the fall. What does that mean? What did that, how did you interpret that at the time?
Well,
and what have you since come to understand?
At the time, what I thought he meant, I was presenting a proposal to a leading group of pension fund leaders who were very interested in rebuilding the U.S. economy and sort of getting the U.S. economy on a sound foot. And I had done incredible deep diving and looking at the U.S. government budget and the U.S. economy by place. So America breaks down to 3,100 counties. And what we had discovered was that the government money had a negative return on investment and could easily be re-engineered to a positive in a way that would create enormous capital gains on the real estate and the economy, and could really help the pension funds make their targets. Because the great concern at that time was, how would the pension funds, you know, sort of support the boomers in their old age? And so we had rolled out an entire presentation on this reengineering of the government budget and doing it place by place in 3,100 counties in a way that would produce huge capital gains for the pension funds and take care of the boomer retirement, sort of rejuvenating, you know, a sort of a 1997 version of Make America Great Again in the face of globalization and what globalization was doing to employment. So the president of CalPERS, who was one of the members, froze and he said, you know, this was Alinsky's plan and they stopped him. And I said, well, you know, what we're talking about is now we have technology that can radically increase learning metabolism in communities that can create enormous equity wealth. And he froze and he looked at me and he said, you don't understand. It's too late. They've given up on the country. They're moving all the money out starting in the fall. He said, you've got to get to Nick, meaning Nick Brady, who'd been the former Secretary of the Treasury, who'd been the chairman of Dillon Reed, where I was a partner. He said, you've got to get to Nick and tell them that it's not too late. It's not hopeless. And I thought he meant, James, that they had given up on investment in the country and they had given direction to all the pension funds to reallocate equity to investment in the emerging markets as part of globalization. And so I thought he meant that the pension funds were going to shift equity and the big investors and the, you know, the big in school endowments, foundation endowments, were going to shift their allocation from U.S. domestic equity to global equity, and not just to the developed markets, but to the emerging markets. So I just thought he was talking about legal reallocation of legal monies. And then what happened was we discovered when he said it's starting in the fall is the beginning of the federal fiscal 1998 year. When the fiscal 1998 year closed, what we discovered was fantastic amounts of money were going missing from HUD. Now, the reason I was focused on HUD is having been a leader of the reform of HUD information systems technology and financial and legal arrangements, I knew that there was no reason for HUD's books to not be absolutely perfect. You know, HUD had the resources, it had the laws, it had everything it needed to have perfect books. Why would fantastic amounts of money start to go missing? And at the time, I had a Senate staffer complain to me, the chief of staff to the senator who was in charge of the Appropriation Committee for HUD, that HUD was, quote, being run as a criminal enterprise. Now, what you need to understand is HUD is run essentially by the Treasury Department, the Department of Justice, the New York Fed member banks with J.P. Morgan Chase in the lead, and a group of big IT contractors at that time, Lockheed Martin, DynCorp was in there. And so you can't run HUD as a criminal enterprise unless they intentionally are organized to run it that way, which I later came to believe. So what we saw was not a movement of the overt equity out of the U.S. What we saw was a covert movement of massive amounts of money being pulled out of the United States to be reinvested. You know, your guess is as good as mine. I think some of it was reinvested in Asia, as he said it would be. But I think some of it really represents an explosion of the covert side of the national security state. And a real vision of, okay, we can run the planet on a unipolar model using the national security state and the war on terror as basically a, you know, a way to assert control of all resources globally. You're looking at a command and control model for all resources, and that necessitated dramatic increases in movements of our military globally, which is exactly what happened.
Just to back up that timeline, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't the first Inspector General report of the DOD missing trillions from 1999, looking at the 98 books?
Yes. Yeah. Now, we found it. It was my attorney who found the HUD IG's testimony on the 1998 year saying the money was missing and they'd given up trying to audit and were just going to quit. Now, if your bank account was missing $59,000, I dare say you wouldn't just give up and say, well, if the bankers promised you don't worry, it won't happen next year, you'd say, no, I want my $59,000 back. So it was, the behavior was bizarre. But then I think it was not that long after we discovered that $1.1 trillion went missing from DOD in 1 year. It was 99 or 2000 and then 2.3 trillion. And that's why when Rumsfeld stood up the day before 9/11 and said there's 2.3 trillion, we thought it was a modified hangout because he didn't mention the 1.1 missing the year before. So it was up to 3.3 or 3.4, depending on how you round up, trillion as of the day of 9/11. And in fact, that Friday, we were coming out with a major front cover story article in Insight magazine about the missing money and how it broke down by state and what it meant to every person. And, you know, whether it was their student loans or the pension funds, this is $65,000 per person. And so we're talking about a dramatic amount of money hitting people, whether it hits them and, you know, it disappears from their pocketbook, or it hits them because they're taking terrible currency debasement and their cost of goods is going up 10% a year.
All right. So you have raised the specter of some of the things that could be enabled with this type of money. For example, underground bases, spraying programs, secret space program, things that sound far-fetched to anyone who thinks, obviously, there must be a financial infrastructure for this. We'd see it in the books. Well, no, we cannot see it in the books. That's the point. What do we know and what do we not know about where this money is actually going?
We don't know. First of all, we don't know how much money this really is in terms of cash or credit, hard credit, because some of the money could be revenues and some expenses. So, for example, we could be occupying Iraq and Afghanistan and taking very valuable minerals and oil out of them, selling the oil and laundering the money back through, or the drug sales back through DOD. I became convinced after many, many years of research that drug money was being laundered through the HUD accounts. So some of this could be revenue, some of this could be expenditures, we don't know. What we do know is there's plenty of anecdotal information that documents that there are extraordinary expenditures going on in terms of underground bases. Now, could that money be clawed through the black budget in the DOD budget? There's a process where money can be clawed out of different agencies and taken into a black budget and is not disclosed because it's a sort of secret budget. So could that, all those underground bases have been funded from the black budget? Yes, but they could also have been funded from this. When the Kennedy assassination happened, if you look at the rise and the percentage of space expenditures as a portion of the budget and the GDP, what happened is after that, it started to fall. What I believe is, in fact, it continued. They just took it dark. And this, you know, these various forms of disappearing or missing money was one of the ways they funded. So I happen to believe that there's tremendous expenditure spent on space that we don't see. If you look at globalization could happen, James, because we had the global satellite infrastructure necessary to ensure enforcement. No investor puts money any place where they cannot enforce. And it was the global satellites and whatever our presence was in space that was very, very critical to allowing globalization and that kind of investment to happen. But the other thing we know is we have tremendous evidence of all sorts of unusual spaceships flying around the planet. You know, and what I've said to various people is, you know, that's $150 trillion of hardware. Where'd it come from? Somebody built it, right? So if you simply look at the kind of hardware that's floating around the planet and flying around the planet and the high technology, you know, it doesn't take a big intuitive leap to say, I'll bet you we built some of it.
Yeah. And even what is on the record that we know that we don't know, the classified space shuttle flights that we know nothing about what they were up there for, or the X-37B, which they like to tout as, well, this mysterious space plane that we don't know anything about, just came back from its latest two-year mission or whatever it is. But that's what we know that we don't know.
So let me bring up another one. One of the things that is so remarkable about the U.S. economy, the U.S. economy is very centrally controlled. And it's controlled because we use government money to control places as opposed to optimize the economy in places. You know, so we waste, for example, if you look at private prisons, I've written a book sort of describing the waste of private prisons. And private prisons in 1996 were costing $154,000 per person per year. I mean, fantastically wasteful amounts of money. And so this negative return on investment has been unbelievably expensive. And in 1996, when we started globalization, add to that extraordinary manipulation of the markets, with some of it was derivatives, but it would have required a real stockpile of money. I mean, you would need, you know, what one investor will call the hammer, or sometimes they'll call it a bazooka. He says, if you have a bazooka, then you don't need to use it. And, you know, but we really created somehow a financial bazooka that no matter, you know, where the gold price wanted to go, we could press it down and you could just layer on derivatives after derivatives. So some of this money, my guess is, was absolutely parked in the exchange stabilization fund and places like that, and use that to help make this global model go, because there are big parts of this global model that are very expensive and have a negative return on investment. It's all about the control and concentration of cash. It's not about the control and sort of optimization of equity. So I think that's another place. Global spraying is one, I believe, is one of these expenses, because if you, no matter where you are in the world, when you sort of watch the spraying and try and count up, okay, how many planes, how many pilots, how much would the spray cost? And you just make a wild, you know, we call it a WAG estimate, wild ass guess. You know, we're talking about something which is fantastically expensive. And so my guess is that some of this money has gone into global spraying. Finally, during the period, if you sort of look at when the money's going missing, and then you look at the offshore havens, there is, you know, it's like the Pillsbury Doughboy. This is leaving and this is rising, and it's almost so perfect. It's unbelievable. So I think a lot of cash has gotten stockpiled offshore in a whole variety of interests. Finally, one of the interesting or more interesting uses, and I can't say this is one of the biggest ones, underground bases and global spraying is pretty big. One of the things you see is all the different fraudsters and money networks seem to have a proclivity for investing in advanced research. So Madoff, some of the money that disappeared through Madoff went to MIT Brain Research. Some of the money that went through Epstein went to MIT Brain Research. And I happen to think that a lot of the political problems we're facing right now, the biggest one is mind control. And I think if you look at how much money has gone into manipulating human beings, manipulating their minds, accessing their minds, building the kind of NSA surveillance we know we have, you know, you're trying to build a global mind that can be centrally controlled. And I think a fantastic amount of money has gone into that research.
Absolutely. And that ties into the DARPA Brain Initiative and also serial right. scamsters like Elon Musk and his Neuralink and things like that. Yeah.
I used to have a friend who was very knowledgeable about Musk and the people around him who kept saying, look, Musk is very, very dark. You know, there's very serious occult things going on here. You have to, you know, pay attention. And not quote Musk. This, you know, this was all to justify me not quoting Musk. And then when I watched the Neuralink, his Neuralink speech, that's a man on a leash. But it was one of the most bizarre speeches I've ever watched in my life. And I've seen a lot of bizarre speeches.
Yeah. There are kind of jokes that go around on the internet that he's some sort of cyborg or something, but it really does make you wonder what exactly his brain is on.
I ran into one person very recently. You know, I used to listen to some of the people who would leave Washington and say, you know, some of the presidents are cyborgs or doubles or, you know, you never know what to make of it. But I dealt with one person not that long ago. You know, one of the things I love about humans is they always have this divine spark. No matter how far gone they are, they've got that divine spark. And, you know, I was raised as a Quaker, so we're big on divine spark, and you have to find the light in everybody. I dealt with a person who had no spark, none. It was every time you talk to them, it was like, you know, when the hourglass spins, they were waiting for their download from the AI and the neural network to tell them what to say next. And it was, I don't know, it was the most bizarre experience, one of the most bizarre experiences of my life. And I said, oh no, could this really be possible?
One never knows. And the thing is that the economic opacity is what enables any of this to potentially be true. We truly have no idea what is going on under the cover of this opacity.
Here's what's interesting. There is a history. What we ought to do, we ought to get a group of us and do a history of secret money for secret operations and secret armies, starting in 47 to 49, or we can even go back to, from, you know, to 1913 in the creation of the Federal Reserve, because it's the fiat currency and the ability to use that fiat currency globally that makes this all go. So it goes back to the Federal Reserve. And we go back, and if you look, there are thousands of people who fought and died to try and stop the secret money for secret operations and secret armies. And that's what it is. It's just secret money, secret operations, secret armies. Forrestal got killed for that reason. McCarthy got killed for that reason. Kennedy got killed for that reason. The people who died in 9/11 got killed for the reason. All the people who were destroyed on the drug narcotics trafficking into their communities, same thing. It's the same story for, you know, almost a century. And yet somehow we never look at it as one continuous story. And that's what it is.
Two very important and unfortunately underreported topics. But that's what we like to do here on the Progressive Commentary Hour, take on the important issues. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.
Brother, brother, there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love and here today. Oh, picket lines and picket signs, don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see.